For years, BreweryDB has been the industry's only professionally curated source of brewery knowledge and responsible for mapping millions of visits to breweries all across the United States. In early 2021, BreweryDB revealed a whole new platform with all new features for craft lovers to plan their unique brewery experience. Find, filter, search, and route your way to breweries worldwide and in your own neighborhood. To take full advantage of the optimized power of BreweryDB and to increase your brew knowledge, visit BreweryDB.com, your digital destination for brewery experiences. Good Beer Matters shares the stories of craft and culture found in every glass, and I'm excited to announce that the Good Beer Matters podcast and BreweryDB are collaborating this year to help you get to the bottom of it. Visit us at BreweryDB.com and GoodBeerMatters.net to finally have the experience you've been missing. My name is Jeremy, and this is Good Beer Matters.
I got into beer and then professionally helped the world pay attention to small and independent craft brewers because I'm a beer lover, because I'm a home brewer. We all use our home brewer for social impact. It's community in a glass. It teaches us about ourselves and each other and agricultural products, different areas of the world. And you can also tie it to relationship building.
If you think about it, all of the beer you enjoy at breweries around the world today began as homebrew. In a literal sense, oftentimes the brewer began as a homebrewer. But in a larger sense, all beer used to be brewed at home long before it became a global commodity. This got me thinking, what role does homebrewing play now in our modern society? My next guest is an expert and a leader who will help get your boil kettles fired up. I've studied, traveled, and tasted my way through some of the best beer the world has to offer. Over the past few years, I've also spoken to beer industry leaders from around the globe. And one thing is certain, the art, the science, and the culture of beer has more of a profound effect on us than we realize. There's a story of craft and culture found in every glass, and I intend to get to the bottom of it. These are the stories of us, of great food and the beer that brings it all together. I hope you enjoy episode 112 of Good Beer Matters with Advanced Cicerone and Executive Director of the American Homebrewers Association, Julia Herz. I have to admit that one of the ways that pulled me, and I use that word deliberately, I did not go quietly and willingly into the world of beer, I have to admit. But what pulled me into this wonderful world that we now occupy and sit in was sitting at a buddy's house one day while he homebrewed, sipping on a beer, wondering, oh, that's cool. I didn't know you could brew beer at home. And then you fast forward, and here we are in a world full of amazing beer, amazing people. And it all really started with brewing at home. And I can't wait to dive into this topic even more with my friend, my guest, and we'll talk about this a little bit later on as well, but also kind of a business partner as well. But let me thank you, Julia Herz, for coming back onto this Good Beer Matters podcast. This is the third time you've been on, if I'm counting correctly, but I'm so glad to have you here. Thank you for coming back.
Jeremy, our history and friendship continues, and we're doing such great things together to help advance our beer studies, knowledge, and those around us, I think. So I'm just honored to always get to spend any time with you, friend.
Oh, you say the sweetest things, especially when I bribe you with beer. But let's get into. So a lot of people know who you are, but let's tap our feet on all the bases. You are, since the last time we talked, you are now an advanced Cicerone. We both took our final test on the same day and passed. So advanced Cicerone, BJCP judge. You once were for a very long time the Brewers Association program director. You were a co-author of Beer Pairing, a must-read tome for anyone who's diving into this this category, this industry. You were the publisher at craftbeer.com. You are now the executive director of the American Homebrewers Association. You are one of the leading beer educators in the U.S. and probably beyond, if we're honest. Is there anything I left out? of that list?
Well, you know my journey in history, and it's still going. So my answer is, sure, there's other things along the way in my body of work. We all have to summarize what we do, and I think you did a very eloquent job of that. I started as a home brewer, and then in the professional pursuits, did many of the things that you just mentioned, and many more, and I've got a heck of a lot more to do.
And is there anything pertinent to the topic of homebrewing that I left out that we should really, you know, kind of stick into the stable of all these things that you've done in beer?
Well, I think it's a beautiful crescendo of full journey that I've gotten to do in terms of no longer being the craft beer program director at the Brewers Association, a COVID-caused interruption in my career, and then to come back and now fill the role as executive director of the American Homebrewers Association. It makes sense. It fits in everything I've ever done. I got into beer and then professionally helped the world pay attention to small and independent craft brewers because I'm a beer lover, because I'm a home brewer. And then now to go to this next step and say, I want more of the world home brewing, and I want to remind the world that have and does home brew to continue to do that because there's so many rewards. That's the anchor right now, and my focus is definitely homebrewing and bringing it to more people.
And that's fantastic because, you know, we were talking about beer, we were talking about craft beer, we were talking about independent beer, and it all started with homebrewing. So it's like we're going back to the beginning to really dive into the story. So let's talk about your story. You said you started as a homebrewer. How and when did that really begin?
Sure. In the early stages of my not legal drinking age career, my brother had a beer can collection. So I really was thinking about beer from a very early age. My parents would take us out from the Maryland to the district, Washington, D.C. We'd go to a place called the Brickskeller. And besides my brother, like dumpster diving and going into dumpsters and finding beer cans on the side of the road, a great place and source for his collection that he still has to this day is and was the Brickskeller in Washington, D.C. More than 500 different beers on the menu, not a establishment that had draft beer even. And so from a very early age, literally before I was 10 years old, I was thinking about beer in different packages, different colors, different types, meaning different styles, from different countries, from different owners, with different stories, right? And it was all around food too. My parents would be drinking and eating, and they'd, you know, make friends with the people around us at the tables. My brother was happy because he was expanding his beer can collection. So in those early days, I think I probably decided I wanted to brew. And then my dad is and was a foodie, so he always encouraged me to taste outside the box, sample food things. Remember the first time he had me try sushi? I remember the first time I had a sandwich and it was wet and soggy and I freaked out and I was super little. And like, he always was like grounding of like, just expand your horizons, be open-minded to new food experiences. So between that and the homebrewing beer can collection from my brother, I started brewing right when I hit 21 and never looked back.
Do you remember the first beer that you brewed?
I do. It was a Scottish ale from a kit. My friend Charlie Gunn and I from Maryland brewed it at his house. I remember brewing it. I remember bottling it. I remember giving it to our friends. I remember, and a lot of people are like, yeah, your first homebrew is never good. And I beg to differ. We followed the directions. We did what was suggested. And we had, at the time in my head, the best beer I had ever tried. It popped with carbonation when we did the Fisher and Grolsch, you know, swing tops, which is what a lot of homebrewers were tracing down in those days for bottles. And it was bright with malt. It wasn't a hop-centric beer, so we didn't have to worry about that from the kit side of things. And I was very, very pleased with it. It was great.
I have to say, my first beer was also from a kit, and I brewed a brown ale, an American brown ale. And I remember thinking, wow, this is really good. I'm kind of good at this. I should do this again. Not really having the perspective that, you know, kit, you brewing from a kit is fantastic. It's fun. It's easy. The cleanup is simple. But if, in contrast or in relation, I should say, it's kind of like pulling a box of brownies off the shelf, mixing water or adding water, mixing it, baking it, and voila, you have brownies. To me, now looking back, it was about that easy, but it was really good. So I always have fond memories and wonderful things to say to those people who are brewing from a kit, because it's hard to mess those up. They're
absolutely
so good.
And I'll jump in and say, today I'm really dabbling in all levels of home brewing, right? The most advanced, you know, brew in one system, all grain, 10 gallon electric, you know, latest and greatest equipment. Also patio brewing with gravity fed system, mash tun on my, you know, back patio table. And then on the floor of the patio, frankly, is the boil kettle. So that's one way. And then I'm also stovetop brewing. I'm doing stovetop brewing from kits. I'm doing stovetop brewings all grain. And I'm also doing steeping grains with extract in small quantities, 1 gallon, all the way up to 10 gallon. So I'm very familiar these days with all levels of home brewing. And I'm here to say it can be as simple or as complex and advanced as you want it to be.
Yeah. And that's great. And, you know, I'm glad you said that, because I've been all grain brewing for many years now. But there are times I want to go back to my stovetop partial mashing. And I mean, it took half the time. There are times if I brew something strong, I don't necessarily want 10 gallons of something strong, because you know what's going to happen. I'm going to drink it, you know? And so it'd be kind of nice to have just 5 gallons of something quick and easy. And so I'm really tempted to go back to how I brewed before on occasion. And so you bring up a really good point too. You don't have to stick yourself into, like, you know, plant your flag on one end. We're all grain brewers only, and we're better, we're cooler. No, there are attributes to each style of home brewing. And that's a great way to think of it. You have different tools in your toolbox for homebrewing.
Absolutely. And I use this analogy lately, and I've evolved it based even on feedback from those on social media who have heard my garden analogy. And then now I will evolve it to help it even resonate more. But the initial gist is when you're a gardener, you raise your hand. Yes, I'm a gardener. I garden in the backyard. I grow things, right? You either go to the garden store or, you know, through an online supply catalog, no different than going to a homebrew shop or through your online retailer for a homebrew shop, you get your ingredients. If you're gardening, you might buy seeds and start those seeds straight in the ground when it's spring and you're going to be able to do it. You might from the garden store buy a garden start of your tomato plants. So it's the tomato plant that's already sprouted, and then you plant that in the garden. But Jeremy, you're over at my house one day when I'm going to be so excited to serve you dinner, and I serve you a lasagna made with tomato sauce. You're not going to look at me and say, "This is homemade tomato sauce, Julia. Wow. Did you use tomatoes from the seed or tomatoes from a start?" You're not going to care about that, right? As long as the quality of the ingredients is there, you're going to have a good final product. The other analogy would be, if I'm making a tomato sauce for that lasagna and I grab tomato sauce from a jar, right, there's your extract. Or I make the tomato sauce from my tomatoes that I harvested, there's really, you know, the initial source of that sauce. Either way, if that story resonates with you, then your mind can kind of really flip the switch on, no matter how you're homebrewing, it doesn't matter. What matters is what ends up in the glass.
Oh, and I love that analogy. I don't think I've heard that before, but to me, that makes me think of, if I'm going to make a marinara sauce and I want to skip some steps, I'm going to grab a can of tomato paste. I'm going to kind of water it down, but I'm going to add my own basil. I'm going to add my own garlic. I'm going to add my own whatever. And that's partial mashing. And that is quick, that's easy, and what a great way to doing it. So you also recently had experience of not only do you brew in different ways, but you brew in different places, and you just went out and I presume you probably filmed a little video, because that's what you do, about brewing while you were camping in your trailer. Can you talk about that a little bit? How was that experience of not having all your stuff there?
Yeah, it was a journey and an experience. I just finished that this past weekend. And what I did was I brewed using my pop-up camper in and out stove. In means you can plug it inside the camper, or out means you can hang it on outside the camper. It's propane powered. Two little burners. Just think your typical camping stove with two burners. That's basically the size. Mm-hmm. And I was at the Wyoming Craft Beer Summit, put on by the Wyoming Craft Brewers Guild. And I not only spoke to the professional brewers in Wyoming about the value of home brewing, not just for their business, but for their own personal reward, their own personal career, their own personal professional development. But I said, I'm going to be doing a demonstration beer in the parking lot. Come visit me. And throughout the brew, and this was just 4 days ago, the weather was bad. Went from 90 degrees the day before I did it to literally like low 50s, high 40s and rainy. So I couldn't do it outside. I had envisioned outside in the parking lot. I had everything set up, tables, couches. And I just said, adjust, go inside. So at different times throughout the day, I probably had 12, 15 brewers rotate in and out of my camper. And they all sat at the little dinette table or on my bed while I was checking temperature and mashing and then boiling. And right now, if I had a camera, I could show you. And you can look on Immaculate Fermentation, which is my Instagram channel, for photos, and I'll eventually get to video posting that, of this little 1 gallon cutie. So it was a 1 gallon all grain brewing batch of beer, and it's a Belgian golden strong ale. And then now, once it's done fermenting in primary, I will add wild plums that I sourced out my backyard down the street at the park here in Lyons, Colorado. So it's going to be a Belgian golden strong with some beautiful wild plums, you know, balancing it out. And this is all inspired by people that do 1 gallon all grain. And there's a movement there for sure. Dan Jablo, who has Small Batch Brewing on Instagram, that's his Small Batch Beer is his channel. I met him at HomebrewCon in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania this year, and he introduced me to that concept. So most people that do 1 gallon are doing extract. I took it one level further, going all grain, and one level further doing it on my camper stove. And it was no different than just being in your kitchen, except for I forgot to bring a few key things and I wasn't as used to that system of dynamic, meaning the footprint around me while I was brewing at the camper.
Yeah, it's funny. It's, as soon as you get everything just right, then you don't want to change it because you know you've got everything down. So it really takes a special mindset to say, hey, let's go brew anything, anywhere. It's a trick. And I think about a chef. I mean, when you're used to having your mise en place, you know, you have everything right where you want it, so you can just move and flow and groove. But when that's not there, you have to think a little bit harder.
It challenges you.
I remember one time, I was trying to brew something, and I was also trying to do a bunch of other stuff, a bunch of honeydews. I was trying to be a multitasker and Mr. Efficient, but that is not my superpower in this world. I am not a multitasker. I prefer to focus and do, you know, something well than do a bunch of things half-heartedly. And I ended up mashing in at, I think, 165 degrees. Not 155 degrees that I originally intended, about an hour later, I checked the conversion and none of the starches had converted. I was thinking, what on the world happened? And then I looked at my thermometer and thought, oh, okay, now I got it. I just wasted all that time and all those ingredients and got to dump it out, and lesson learned. So
you never tried it? You never brought it to fruition?
No, I did taste the wort. It was going to be amazing, but at that point, there was just too many distractions, and I had already kind of biffed it. So, that's where I keep notes of all of my beers, and all of the failures, I write down exactly what I did. So I know I know what not to do next time.
One thing to jump in to add is it's not just chefs testing at home, right? And that's the analogy you're using, which is very appropriate. If I'm a chef and I'm going to test out a new recipe, I'm not going to make 20 plates of it. So when brewers, more advanced home brewers that brew bigger batches, or professional brewers brew a pilot, that pilot batch, which is a test batch, is often very big in volume. Why not go with just the 1 gallon test, you know, the little cutie, I call it, the 1 gallon jug, and test it out? You have a lot less investment financially.
Yeah.
And then if you love it, just brew it again, but brew more. So to me, starting small is a really good way to go. And then you can always scale up from there.
Again, great advice. I've always thought about, if I'm going to spend the time, I want to brew as much as I can within reason. But, there are pros and cons to that mode as well. One thing I want to dive into, though, before we get too far into reminiscing about our wins and losses in the homebrewing world, let's get a little historical perspective on homebrewing. How far back does it go? I mean, where does homebrewing live in the history of beer? There are more than 100 unique styles of beer, each with their own set of ingredients, process, guidelines, history, and experience. If you're a beer lover, an industry leader, or somewhere in between, a better knowledge of beer style will improve your life and your work.
Welcome to A Sense of Beer Style, essential beer style training for those who want to lead in food and beverage. I'm Julia Herz.
And I'm Jeremy Storton.
We're advanced cicerones, beer judges, home brewers, and we're excited to guide you through the vast and wonderful world of beer styles.
Well, I'm not a historian, but it lives as the first level of whatever form of homebrewing was discovered. If we're discovering ancient breweries, that's because those ancient brewers started homebrewing at a fundamental, almost primitive level, around their camp stove or around their campfire. So I would say homebrewing is the first form of brewing, winemaking, and any form of fermentation, except for when Mother Nature did it. I'm sure in Mother Nature, there were trees that had hollowed out sections, that bees had hives, and then, you know, rainwater caught and it diluted the honey enough where the water then was making the honey more accessible to wild yeast. And you definitely have Mother Nature as the first home brewer. But then beyond that, it was us, right? In Egypt, in Mesopotamia, in so many areas of the globe. And then fast forward, now I'm really going fast forward, you have Prohibition, that interrupted commercial alcohol fermentation and sales in the U.S. from the 1920 to 1933. But you can sure as heck bet that when that privilege, not right, because it's not a right to sell alcohol, although the great experiment failed during Prohibition, more people started homebrewing that way, right? They wanted to still have access to fermented beverages. And then you get through the 50s, and then you work your way into the 70s, and then you have this whole revolution of people traveling to other great brewing nations, Germany, Belgium, England. So many pioneer craft brewers today in the U.S. and elsewhere talk about the beers that they were discovering. And then they wanted to get us going in the U.S. And at the same time, in the late 70s and 80s, when you had breweries like Sierra Nevada and Anchor Steam really starting to rise up and get some traction, you also had in Boulder, Colorado, the American Homebrewers Association forming under founder Charlie Papazian, who's definitely, you know, a guiding light for so many that have found their way to craft beer. And then the AHA started. We published Zymergy Magazine, 1978. Still today, we publish Zymergy Magazine every other month. And if you're an American Homebrew Association member, you get that. And then by 2013, and I'm skipping a lot of stuff, Jeremy, we had homebrewing get legalized individually on all 50 states. The last two were Mississippi and Alabama. 1978 wasn't just when the AHA started, but it was also when Jimmy Carter made it legal to homebrew up to 200 U.S. gallons per family household. And then federally, the stage was set. The states started to fall like dominoes and agreeing to it. And then by 2013, we had those last two states, meaning that all 50 states were then allowing homebrewing in some form.
And that's where I'm not a historian either. But when you hear about the story of alcohol, of prohibition, of all these things, if you pay any attention to any historical stories following the line of beer, it's fascinating. It's a wonderful tale full of drama and woe and near misses and you know, big wins and epic failures. And it's kind of an exciting story when you look at it. One of the more exciting stories is, you know, you just mentioned Jimmy Carter made homebrewing legal again in 79, long after Prohibition was repealed, because, you know, oversight. But that's when these people who were formerly criminals, formerly artists and pirates, came out of the woodwork and started brewing beer and ultimately began the craft beer movement in the U.S. What is the story with how homebrewing really began this industry that we now take for granted?
Well, I think you had the infrastructure getting built, right? When you were brewing, and not in my era, I'm a little young still, but some of the early home brewers didn't have access to get a lot of ingredients. They were barely able to get their hands on malt extract and bagged hops in some form. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but the stage started to grow and get set as we had that whole system of education growing, right? American Homebrewers Association, Zymergy Magazine, our website, homebrewersassociation.org, and many others were publishing magazines and starting to get books out there. So you have this education component. You also needed the infrastructure to have homebrewers access ingredients. Today, we record on homebrewersassociation.org. We have the database up there to look at. 600 plus homebrew shops. That didn't happen overnight. That took decades.
Yeah.
And that's a global number. And then you also have in the U.S. at least, with more globally, 2,000 plus homebrew clubs. So you've got this convergence of, okay, the stage is set for it legally to be allowed, late 70s. You have these people that are on the home side really wanting to scale up and go pro, right? And so they're starting microbreweries and brew pubs. Mm-hmm. And then the only way that most people really could get their hands dirty with it in a good way was practicing and brewing. And so then you have more demand for ingredients on a small scale that the world had never seen. If you were kind of a industry partner selling to breweries, you're used to selling to the big conglomerates, you know, Anheuser-Busch, MillerCoors, and they buy in mass quantities. Things had to get small and available. I think of Brees Malting, who really invested in homebrewing in the early days, and they said they wanted to make sure they always included the homebrewers. I think of White Labs in the early days and Y Yeast and yeast companies. They didn't have to package their yeast in smaller quantities, more cost, more effort. But it was worth it because they were growing up the next, the next customers. And the thing I want to jump to is I spent a lot of time helping set the stage on where homebrewing has been, but I don't get enough chance to talk about where homebrewing is going. And so that's one of the things is history matters. We learn from that. I'm after, on the flip side, though, homebrewing 2022 and here forward, right? The history has been set, and I love talking about where we're going with the hobby and how the hobby is and will continue to nurture so many people in therapeutic ways because hobbies are rewarding, in sensory ways, in ways to develop your confidence, in ways to develop your professional pursuits. So that's a lot of the picture, too, is not just looking backwards and learning from it, but looking forwards and talking about where are we taking the hobby.
Well, and that's an exciting topic, and I'm going to put a pin in that just for a second because I kind of want to finish on that because what a great notion that would be. One of the things that I've noticed being a home brewer I'm going to say spending a lot of time in Oregon as craft beer really exploded in the aughts and the teens, I've noticed that there's really an ecosystem. You don't have the breweries and the consumers. You have the secondary markets of the malt and the hops, the tertiary markets of the magazines and the writers and so on and so forth. And you have this ecosystem that really creates this beer industry, this tribe of beer aficionados. And a major part of that are these homebrewers. And they are a significant part of this community. And I've been kind of surprised to see their role in this larger beer ecosystem, particularly where I spent time. You have all these really knowledgeable, excellent brewers who are also consumers that are putting pressure from below on these brewers to do a better job because they are by default educating the consumer. Have you experienced that in different places as well, as far as the how the home brewers have really helped kind of push this industry forward, especially the quality?
1,000%. Everything from the styles that brewers make today. Yeah. Think about the history of so many styles, American brown ale, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Pete's Wicked Ale. You got Yeah, well, and before that, it was Texas homebrewers that helped get that on the map. And you've got beer styles that have come along because homebrewers were tinkering, right? Yeah. Or people that were in food and beverage also are, even though they're pro, they're also homebrewers. So it's definitely an ecosystem, and I like that word, of a very good synergy. Great American Beer Festival is in October every year. For many, many years now, we've had the pro-am part of the competition, pro meaning professional, am meaning amateur. And we historically get close to 50 to 100 entries in pro-am, where you've got a home brewer partnering with a pro brewer, and the pro brewer agrees to brew that home brewer's beer and enter it with their name attached to it. That's pretty big influence. And I guarantee you a multitude of the winners or even the entrants from Pro-Am have become, flagships or beers that commercial breweries definitely get to make. I will point out, though, the majority of home brewers are not in clubs. The majority of home brewers are never going to brew with a brewer, right, and enter a Pro-Am. Mm-hmm. The majority of home brewers are not entering competitions. It's the homebrewer spectrum that we all have to keep in mind. And so the beginning brewer that maybe is doing the 1 gallon at home and serving it to their friends, that's never going to engage in a homebrew club or a competition, they're just as valid. They are then discerning not just palates, but wallets walking around, more informed on what beer they're going to buy, right, from those craft brewers and the like. So it's always interesting to think about who's homebrewing, but the majority of homebrewers are not busy whispering in the ear of breweries. They're, though, simply the ones that are purchasing behind the scenes beers that are help setting the trends and establishing what's going to sell well and what doesn't.
Well, and I think you just started answering my follow-up question to this is, as homebrewers really helped build this craft beer industry, you know, what is their role now? So you just kind of explained that they're kind of help keeping, I call it this benevolent pressure on the professional commercial brew industry to, for lack of better words, to keep them honest, to keep them pushing for better. How else do you see how this homebrewing community, this homebrewing sect of this tribe of beer lovers is still relevant today now that this industry is built?
Well, I would say that homebrewers, even on the beginning levels or keeping it as simple as possible levels to the most advanced, we all use our homebrew for social impact. And that's a huge influence. Many of us have used our homebrewers to, and I tell this story a lot, but I love it, it's effective. When somebody passes away or a neighbor just had a baby, you walk across the street and back to the lasagna, you give them a lasagna. But when you don't give them a lasagna and you give them one of your homebrews, it's even more meaning. It's even more, wow, look at the effort behind this. Then homebrewers also help fundraise with their homebrews. There's many festivals out there that are actually legally supported that choose donation causes and or charitable foundations and help raise money for many, many groups over the years. We just, at the HomebrewCon, we awarded an award. It's been given away many, many years, called Radagast. And it's after acknowledging homebrew clubs that are the most worthy of being dubbed, you are leading in social impact. And Troub, which is a Pennsylvania homebrew club, for about 9 years now has put on a festival that's raised more than $325,000 for multiple sclerosis. So they are using their homebrew as a cause for other causes. Craft brewers absolutely use that too. We also are seeing homebrewers really push the envelope on ingredients when it comes to collaboration. I've been traveling the country and I've been hiding my hose clamp ring, which is a little ring that I wear on my right finger. Jeremy's laughing. And a hose clamp ring is a tool that's used by many a homebrewer if you keg your homebrews. And it helps connect the vinyl tubing that you push the beer out to the keg that the beer is in. And that metal hose clamp you can wear as a ring. I've worn it for years. It helps me in many respects. It's also street cred, right? People see it and they know I'm a home brewer. And so I've been stashing that, meaning geocaching that, in multiple areas of the country. I've geocached it in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, San Diego, Indianapolis, and most recently Casper, Wyoming. And Casper, Wyoming was 4 days ago. So give it a hot minute before somebody finds it. But the other three locations, people have found my host clamp ring that's been geocached within 48 hours. And they have won an opportunity to collaborate on a homebrew with me. Well, the creativity that I'm busy talking to these homebrewers, some of them are in clubs, some of them aren't, on what they want to brew is off the charts incredible. And so, you know, I'm going to be brewing with the Snafu president and vice president Adam and Kim in Reno, Nevada, who found my host clamp ring in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, a porter. We're going to split the porter batch. Part of the porter will have choke cherry juice that I harvested out my backyard. So it's a porter choke cherry porter. Sounds amazing to me. And the other one is going to be a juniper porter, where I'm harvesting the juniper berries here, and they will get the ingredients for their porter. So that creativity, that's an example of homebrewers doing it just because they love it and just because they want to continue to up the game on flavor exploration and fun.
And I've also noticed, and I might be speaking out of turn, but I don't think I am, there's kind of parallel worlds. When you have all of these artists at home, these people who are pushing their homebrew and doing some interesting things, the commercial side of the brewing industry takes notice. And they, granted, they can't make every batch because it just doesn't pencil out when you add all these different ingredients, but they're paying attention to what the homebrewers are doing and what the consumers are drinking and looking for. But the parallels seem to go out to, I've noticed, you know, in the world of wine, in the world of bread, in the world of cheese, I mean, there are people doing some really great, interesting things and pushing whatever their industry is forward and much farther than it was, partly because you have people like homebrewers or people with that mindset who, hey, I want to make this better and I want to do something really interesting that's never been done before.
Yeah. And you can also tie it to relationship building.
Yeah.
So many dads and daughters brew together, moms and sons, husbands and wives, right? Neighbor to neighbor. It's not just a flavor exploration of fun and sensory reward. It's also relationship building. And where you can go with it is traditions and rituals that you brew together with somebody over many years. And then you not only get to know the beer better and what you're brewing better and the ingredients behind it and the process, but you're also getting to know that individual that you're brewing with better. So many of the stories when I talk to homebrewers are not just about what's in the glass, but it's about who they brewed it with, right? So combined brew days, a brew-in, right? People gather to brew in their cul-de-sac, in their backyard, come over to my house Thursday night, I'm brewing in my kitchen. That's how most people brew. Some people brew alone, for sure, mm-hmm. I certainly do, but what about when it's time to bottle? Great excuse to have some friends over, right?
Yep.
So the relationship building aspect of it too, to me, is a whole nother anchor to the hobby that I think should, you know, make it on top of one of the best hobbies in the world list.
How do you feel, or not, what's your take on, you know, brewing can also be, you know, a relationship builder, like you said, but, you know, brewing beers relating to stories or experiences you've had before. What's your take on that? And I'll give you an example just to give you a little bit of time to think about it. But that last beer that I brewed, I think I sent you a sample of it. It was that, I called it my Roja. It was a rosemary orange honey ale. That to me, reminded me of a beer that I had in Spain. And it was just basically an easy drinking blonde ale or something to that effect. But they infused it with honey where the bees had pollinated rosemary flowers. And so you got these beautiful flavors that were perfectly made for food pairing, especially with Spanish food. And so I wanted to brew a beer that honored that experience and that story. What is your take on brewing to your stories and your experiences?
That's the beauty of working with ingredients, and then you can bring a story into the beer, right?
Yeah.
I think you get it, and you then created what you guessed. Yes, you graciously shipped that to me, and I enjoyed it greatly. You're very excellent and schooled chef of marrying of different flavors together and is incredible. And so I don't really think I'm answering it in an eloquent way, but of course it ties to stories. My Belgian Golden Strong that I'm going to infuse wild plums into secondary fermentation that I brewed on my camper pop-up stove, that's a story. And I made that, that all came to be because of my journey. Right. I also even put on social media, hey, I've got these wild plums. Should I make it? Should I infuse these in a Belgian Golden Strong Ale, or should I make a sparkling dry mead or honey wine with these wild plums? And so my social media network helped guide me to Belgian Golden Strong. Predominantly, my followers wanted me to make the beer over the mead. I could make both and I still might. But yeah, the story behind what you've got, and then homebrewers also have the creativity and ability to package our beer and do a label, right? We buy amazing craft beer at the store. It's on the can is the story, on the bottle label is the story. We too can do the same thing. And many a homebrew that I've been given has some of the homebrewer's story personally or on that beer right on the package. And that adds to it as well.
Yeah, and so we're talking about all these wonderful reasons to brew, time spent with each other, to celebrate, to commiserate, to be creative, to create experiences. But I think you and I and everyone listening have met those people who have, you know, maybe they've dabbled in home brewing, maybe they tried it once or twice in college, but they just didn't come back to it because, granted, it is a lot of work. It's a lot of work to do. It's a lot of work to learn. And another reason that I hear people not homebrew is because there's plenty of really good, maybe sometimes better beer out there in the market. Why would I spend all my time brewing in the garage? I have my answer to that question, but what do you say to those people to try to get them to come back to homebrewing?
Sure. Whether you've never homebrewed before, and if we're lucky enough to have you listening, thank you and join us, or whether you brewed many years and then have stopped, it's all about finding reasons why. Why would you brew? And at the American Homebrewers Association, we give you reasons. When you get Zymergy Magazine every other month, you're reminded of the exploration that you can find, or you know, National Homebrew Competition award medal winning, gold medal winning recipes right in front of you to try to brew. You also have homebrew holidays that we host on an annual basis. Learn to Homebrew Days coming up November 5th. We would love you to join us. It's free to join. You don't have to be a member, but you join a global community when you sign up to join to brew on a day like that. So the reasons to brew are really a big part of it. Also, too, if you classify yourself as a home brewer because you only if you brew once a month or every month, that's not necessary. You could only brew a few times a year and still be a home brewer. The thing is with your equipment, you know, sitting in your garage or down in the basement, you bought it for a reason at a certain point, and that reason was reward. So making time to get back to that. It's just like the home chef that says, I haven't made chickpea chili in a while. Boy, and then all of a sudden your mind just gets elicits with memories and sweet notions of the smells and aromas. When you homebrew, there's nothing better than that bubbling carboy, which is the fermentation vessel that shows you activity of the fermentation and the yeast are eating the sugars. Meanwhile, the yeast are feeling the vibrations within your home. Listening and getting in sync with the music that you play and giving you aromas if you walk up to the airlock, right? That is giving off, you know, volatilizing out the CO2 as the yeast eat the sugars. So it's giving you aromas and then just looking at it. Looking at a fermentation vessel is therapeutic and calming. It's like watching a fire, you know, burn and glow. So I would say to anyone that has never homebrewed or used to homebrew and wants to get back to it, dust off your equipment, get somebody over that's brewed recently so it's a little less overwhelming, or go on to any one of the resources. We have an easy amber ale as our entry-level recipe. We talk you through it in video. We provide the ingredients and the recipe. You literally just can take that to your local homebrew shop or online, order those ingredients, and you're going to have everything you need. Then you just have to clear your schedule. It's only a few hours to brew a partial grain batch or an extract batch, and you're off and running.
Yeah, and that's a good note. I mean, this will publish before November 5th, I think you said, the Learn to Homebrew Day. And so unless my wife and family have other plans for me, I think I will plan on brewing that day, and I'll put a shout out to anyone in my area. It's like, hey, if you're curious, you want to learn, you want to help, come on out. I think that would be fun for all homebrewers to do, and all those who are interested in homebrewing. Is, that's how we all kind of got started. We're like, ooh, what's that? That's kind of cool. And, get curious and give it a try.
Love it.
And so that pin that I put in earlier, you're talking about the future of homebrewing. I want to pull that out now. Because for me, homebrewing can be a journey. It can be a relationship. It can be so many different things. But how is that journey, or how is that the idea of homebrewing expanding not only forward but outward? What's in your crystal ball for the future of homebrewing?
So, helping homebrewers make the best beer in the world is one of the missions of the American Homebrewers Association. And when you get the resources that you have when you do membership, less than $50 a year, you will have all the access you need to brew world-class beer. The second piece is bringing people in from all walks of life, right? We want to make sure that homebrewing feels accessible to all, that we're inviting everyone to the homebrewing party. And so marginalized populations, women who traditionally aren't as big in the numbers as men for beer drinkers or brewers, homebrewing is the place where you can get your chops no matter what walk of life you are. Beer has no gender. It should have no barriers. And homebrewing, especially because it's up to you. You brew in your kitchen, no one can tell you you can or can't do that. It's totally up to you. So looking forward for homebrewing, looking to really make others across all spectrums feel invited to the homebrewing party. And then the aspect of making beer on a more advanced level is a little overwhelming for some. So simplifying the growth aspect of it, giving people tools to know how to step up from extract, then to steeping grains, then to partial grains where you're converting and mashing your grains, then to all grain. That's all there. And I think you'll continue to see resources from the American Homebrewers Association on that. We're also working on a multitude of fun plans behind the scenes. In terms of competitions, the Beer Judge Certification Program, which the AHA helped start in 1985, is alive and well and going strong. There's 8,000 plus beer judges that are regularly logging points. Well, I'd like to see the number of beer judges growing, because the better you know how to taste beer and sample, and this is Jeremy, you're in my sweet spot,
yeah.
And I'll let you talk about what we've got in the mix, the more you can put another notch in your confidence cap, your resume, your potential brewing journey. So becoming a beer judge to me is definitely front and center and a very, very valuable thing. And there's lots of other things, just got to give us a year or two to get going under this new tenure of me as the new executive director. A governing committee that advises staff is newer as a group. We've got a lot of good members that are engaged. We have 37,000 members at the American Homebrewers Association. And so we've got an amazing group of voices led by their volunteer leaders. And I can't wait to share, once we're physically sharing, what's new and in the mix starting in 2023.
Well, quick question before I launch into kind of a segue into the next topic. But when you brew, do you prioritize creativity or adherence to style?
I go with what I'm very pretty frenetic brewer based on the universe speaks and I'll try it. So I don't have an agenda. I'm not ticking my way through the styles to brew Beer Judge Certification Program style 1-2 to the end. I'm not like that. So it's just to me based on what's going on at the time and the week and the month.
So years ago, after I had learned to homebrew, I had homebrewed a few batches and I did my kit, and then I moved quickly on to partial mashing on the stove. And that's just where, I've got the malt extract there ready to go, but I'm adding my own choices of grains to create what I want. So it's kind of a perfect world between all grain and kit brewing. And that was partial mashing. It was fantastic. I need to do it again. Early on, I took an advanced homebrewing class Oh gosh, I can't. I'll think of the brewer's name after we hang up on this call, I'm sure. But really incredible, prominent brewer in the Central Oregon beer scene. He was a home brewer. He was part of the club that I was with. He brewed like 3-4 times a month because he wanted to learn ingredients. So he was a really knowledgeable guy, perfect guy to teach this advanced homebrewing class. And I remember the very first day. Just he asked, you know, what styles and do you like to brew? And my response was something like, I don't like brewing to style. I like brewing what I like. And you could tell that the room just kind of quit quiet. He kind of shook his head and he said, we'll fix that. and at first I was a little put off, but I've since learned what that is. You know, to be able to pick a style out of the BJCP style guidelines and brew a beer to spec, to brew it so it falls within those guidelines. To be able to do that every time, to me, that means you know how to brew. You know how to hit those numbers, hit those targets, and you know, it kind of like at a firing range, you can hit those targets with a tight grouping. But getting back to that creativity piece, once you know how to brew a Belgian Golden Strong, now you can brew a Belgian Golden Strong with a this and a that. And I think one of the beers I brewed this past winter was a Belgian Golden Strong, and I aged it on oak chips with a little bit of a cachaça. And I wanted to hit some targets, and I wanted to explore a flavor profile. So I was able to honor those styles, but also be creative at the same time. I think there's room for both, for those adherence to the styles and that creativity. What's your take on that?
You definitely touch upon some of the norms of behavior and expectation within the beer community that are a little rigid. It's like talking about the wine community, yeah. And there's some snobbery there, and definitely some things to work on. Beer is grounded when the ingredients are married in a very good way. That is proven by examples of each beer style, right? Beer styles aren't just lager and ales. If you're a beginner listening to this, I'm trying to bring you along. Beer styles are way broader than that. So the style guidelines from a multitude of organizations, Beer Judge Certification Program and the Brewers Association being two, represent a version of beers that are established styles that are rewarding and are worthy of brewing again and again and again and drinking again and again. Yeah. But Jeremy, your question to that guy, I think he should have been open-minded to say, hey, maybe this is the next Rembrandt in brewing and I want somebody that colors outside of the lines and to show me. I think his answer was a little like, I know the establishment, you're not part of the establishment, and I will help you understand the establishment. That only gets you halfway there as an educator. I think educators in beer need to spend more time learning from the newbies, yeah, and letting them make mistakes, letting us brew along and fuddle along and not brew to style. Because you know what? That next great beer style could be there. Look at the styles that have been established in the last few years. Brut IPA, mm-hmm. You know, juicy or hazy, right? All these, I'm having pickle beers left and right, which are incredible.
I had a Katarina Sour for the first time in the, 6 months ago. And it was amazing. You know, stuff that didn't exist not that long ago.
Right. So that's my answer to that is I think the establishment within any community that has, you know, norms and traditions needs to spend time listening to the newbies as opposed to telling the newbies how to work within the establishment.
And it seems to me, too, and I love that because, you know, how are we going to move off in an interesting direction if we don't allow people to go in a different direction than the pack? That being said, if I were the next Rembrandt of homebrewing and this instructor said, nope, you need to do it this way, well, that would be one thing. I think another way of looking at it, the way that I now look at it is, okay, you want to create something that's never been created before? That's amazing. I can't wait to see what you come up with. But first, let me show you how to draw a line. Let me show you how to draw a line with different textures, draw a line with different tonality. Let me give you a skill set so that you can then execute on this amazing path that you're destined for. To me,
I like that analogy.
To me, that's where I find solace in the beer styles, which of course, beer styles are not rules. They're just a way to communicate what the brewers have already done, right? And so I think it pays in dividends to honor what has already come. You know, I'm not going to create a new fusion of West Coast surf blues if I don't listen to Sublime, if I don't listen to Jimi Hendrix, if I don't listen to, you know, the classics, you know, and loosely termed the classics. But it helps me to know what has come before so that I can try and create something new.
Yep.
So we're kind of hovering around this whole beer style thing now. So when it comes to understanding the styles, this is where you and I have created this project. And here's a grand announcement that is no big surprise, but you and I have partnered to get style information and education out to the world of beer professionals and even homebrewers and beer enthusiasts. Why is that important to you? I know why it's important to me and why we're partnering, but why is that important to you that people know beer styles?
I think beer styles do help ground you. I like the way you were just describing it. And if anyone is going to expand their profession, expand their beer studies for personal enjoyment, whether you're testing into Beer Judge Certification Program, the Cicerone Program, any number of programs, or you're a beer buyer, you're a bartender, you're a server, you own an establishment that serves food and beverage, you're in the food and bev industry, or you're a creative type that wants to work with fermentables, particularly malted barley, then the beer styles help you understand a series of classic combinations that take you to very pleasing places. There's just no way around saying that if you study the beer styles, let me say this differently. If you study the beer style guidelines, you will be better at brewing beer and appreciating beer.
Excellent. And so that's why you and I have created this resource, the Sense of Beer Style, Stylecast, is to help however understanding beer styles will help you in your advancement. This is what this is there for. So I know we're running out of time. I am going to put some things that I hope to talk about. I know we've got the Learn to Homebrew Day coming up. I'll put that in the show notes. The Homebrew Con in San Diego in 2023. I'm looking forward to hopefully going to that. One of the things, to kind of wrap this up, and some of these we've already talked about before, but tomorrow you get to be the queen of the homebrewing world for a day, and which is kind of funny because you kind of are already. So what's the first thing you want to change?
Change in homebrewing is the notion that it's hard to brew or that you can't brew world-class beer. Very easy answers.
Perfect.
Those two answers, absolutely.
And then part of your day as queen of the homebrew world, you get to go anywhere in the world for a meal and a beer on the house. Where would you go and what would you choose?
Top of a mountain, somewhere on the Colorado Front Range, picnic style. I brought all my stuff and it has a multitude of 3 or 4 beers and a multitude of certain dishes and I have the day off.
That's fantastic. And lastly, why does good homebrew matter?
Good homebrew matters just like good beer matters, as our friend Jeremy Storton will tell us and has. Good homebrew matters because it's rewarding. It's community in a glass. It teaches us about ourselves and each other and agricultural products, different areas of the world. The list goes on and on. Good homebrew matters because it's good. It's good to homebrew.
Awesome. And, you know, Julia, thank you so much for coming on and talking homebrew with me. I look forward to the day when we actually get to brew together. That'll be fun. But thank you for the work you're doing for homebrewers and for the commercial brewers. I would just really appreciate everything you've done.
You're very sweet, Jeremy. Thanks for the opportunity. I guess I'll wrap it up by saying it better. What I just answered is homebrewing makes life more delicious. That's my line and I'm sticking to it. And, you know, check out homebrewersassociation.org. A lot of our resources are free even. And then if you join, you'll just up your game exponentially. And I can't wait to meet you and talk about what you're brewing.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I admit that homebrewing takes a lot of time, effort, knowledge, and money to do well. But I found the upside of homebrewing far surpasses what we lose in a brew day. If you have never brewed, I urge you to try brewing with some buddies or reach out to a local homebrew club. You may find yourself a member of a new tribe. In the next episode, we take a closer look at the problem with carbon dioxide that has always been there and the new solution that should have been. Good Beer Matters is a show about great beer, great friends, and the experiences we create together. But it's also about better beer education so you can level up your game. So if you're a beer and food professional or even a beer enthusiast, then please subscribe to Good Beer Matters podcast and go to goodbeermatters.net for more resources and next steps. After that, grab a beer, hang out with friends, and let the world open up. Thank you for listening. Cheers.